Side 12. The Shining Ones. The Tomilly, Book 2. By David Eddings. Continuing on page 413.
We want to think about that for a while, though, Vanyan added. Sparhawk and I are still debating the issue, but I think we'll want to make some show of marching north. If we leave here in about a week, with banners flying and 5,000 knights added to the forces we've gathered in this general area, we'll have Zalasta's full attention. If we go out to sea, he won't know we're coming, and that might give him the leisure to sniff out some details of Stragan's plans for our special celebration of the Harvest Festival. Both ideas have an element of surprise involved. We are quibbling about which surprise would disrupt Zalasta's plans the most.
The training of Tomil horses began immediately. Tinian's knights, of course, complained bitterly. The riding horses favored by the Tomil gentry were too small and delicate to carry armored men, and the oversized plow horses used by Tomil farmers were too slow and docile to make good war horses. They were always rushed now. Calador had given the order, and it was irrevocable. The murders would take place during the Harvest Festival, whether their other plans were fully in place or not, and every minute brought the holiday that much closer. It was 5 days following the return of Sparhawk and his friends from northern Aton that a runner reached Mithurin with a message from Khalad. Nirtai admitted the weary Aton to the sitting room, where Sparhawk and Vanyan were arguing the relative merits of their opposing plans. Wordlessly, the messenger handed Khalad's note to Sparhawk. "My lord," he read the characteristically abrupt note aloud, "the earthquake has jumbled the northeast coast. Don't rely on any charts of the area. You're going to have to come by sea, however. There's no way we can climb down the wall, particularly not with trolls waiting for us at the bottom. And Gessa, Kring, and I will be waiting with the Aetons and Takumi's Paloi a couple of leagues south of where the wall dives into the Tomil Sea. Don't take too long to get here. The other side is up to something."
"That throws both your plans out the window, doesn't it?" Emperor Sarabian noted. "You won't be able to go by land because you can't climb down the wall. And you can't go by sea because the sea's filled with uncharted reefs.
And we've only got about 2 days to make the decision," Itanya added. "The forces we're sending north are going to have to start moving at least a week before the festival, if they're going to reach the North Cape in time to spring our second surprise on Zalasta."
"I'd better go have a talk with Captain Sorgai," Sparhawk said, rising to his feet.
"He and Calador are down in the main pantry," Stragan advised him. "They're both Camorians, and Camorians like to be close to food and drink."
Sparhawk nodded, and he and Vanyan quickly left the room. An almost immediate friendship had sprung up between Calador and Sorgai. They were, as Stragan had pointed out, both Camorians, and they even looked much alike. Both had curly hair, though Sorgai's was nearly silver by now, and they were both burly men with heavy shoulders and powerful hands.
"Well, Master Clough," Sorgai said expansively as Sparhawk and Vanyan entered the large, airy kitchen storeroom. "Have you solved all the world's problems yet?"
Captain Sorgai always called Sparhawk by the alias he had used the first time they had met.
"Hardly, Sorgai. We've got one that maybe you can solve for us, though."
"Get the money part settled first, Sorgai," Calador recommended. "Old Sporehawk here, he gets a little vague when the time comes to settle up."
Sorgai smiled.
"I haven't heard that dialect since I left home," he told Sparhawk. "I could sit and listen to Calador talk by the hour. Let's not worry about money yet. The advice is free. It starts costing you money when I lift my anchor up off the bottom." "We have to go to a place where there's been an earthquake recently," Sparhawk told him. "Kirik's son just sent me a message. The earthquake has changed things so much that all the old maps are useless."
"Happens all the time," Sorgai told him. The estuary that runs up to Vardenay changes her bottom every winter.
How do you deal with that?
Sorgai shrugged.
We put out a small boat with a strong sailor to do the rowing and a clever one to heave the sounding line. They lead us through.
Isn't that sort of slow?
Not nearly as slow as trying to steer a sinking ship. How big an area got churned up by the earthquake?
It's sort of hard to say.
Guess, Master Clough. Tell me exactly what happened, and give me a guess about how big the danger spot is.
Sparhawk glossed over the cause of the sudden change in the coastline and described the emergence of the escarpment.
No problem, Sorgai assured him. How did you arrive at that conclusion, Captain?
Venyan asked him.
We won't have to worry about any reefs to the north of your cliff, my lord. I saw something like that happen on the west coast of Rendor one time. You see, what's happened is that the cliff keeps on going. It runs on out to sea, under the water. So once you get north of it, the water's going to be 1,000 feet deep. Not too many ships I know of draw that much water. I'll just take along some of the old charts. We'll go out about 10 leagues and sail north. I'll take my bearings every so often, and when we get 6 or 8 leagues north of this new cliff of yours, we'll turn west and run straight for the beach. I'll put your men ashore up there with no trouble at all.
And that's the problem with your plan, Sparhawk, Venyan said. You've only got 100 ships. If you take both the knights and their horses, you'll only be able to take 1,500 up there to face the trolls.
Is a win in this year argument real important to you two?
Kalidor asked.
We're just looking for the best way, Kalidor,
Sparhawk replied.
Then why not combine the two plans?
Have Sorgai start north first thing in the morning, and you mount up your armies and ride up that way as soon as you get organized. When Sorgai gets to a place 10 leagues or so south of the wall, he can feel his way into shore. You meet him there, and he starts ferrying your army around the reef and puts you down on the beach north of the wall. Then you can go looking for trolls, and Sorgai can drop his anchor and spend his time fishing.
Sparhawk and Venyan looked at each other sheepishly.
It's like I was a-sayin', Sorgai, Kalidor grinned. The gentry ain't got hardly no common sense at all. I believe it's 'cause they ain't got room in their heads for more'n one idea at a time.
Inevitably, the day arrived when the relief column was scheduled to depart for Aton. It was before dawn when Mirtai came into the bedroom of the Queen of Alenia and her prince consort.
Time to get up, the giantess announced.
Don't you know how to knock?
Sparhawk asked, sitting up in bed.
Did I interrupt something?
Never mind, Mirtai, he sighed. It's a custom, that's all.
Foolishness. Everybody knows what goes on in here.
Isn't it almost time for you and Kring to get married?
Are you trying to get rid of me, Sparhawk?
Of course not.
Kring and I have decided to wait until after all of this is finished. Our weddings are going to be a little complicated. We have to go through 2 ceremonies in 2 parts of the world. Kring's not very happy about all the delay.
I can't for the life of me see why,
Aelana said innocently.
Men are strange.
Mirtai shrugged.
They are indeed, Mirtai. But how would we amuse ourselves without them?
Sparhawk dressed slowly, pulling on the padded, rust-stained underclothing with reluctance, and eyeing his black-enameled suit of steel work clothes with active dislike.
Did you pack warm clothing? Aelana asked him. The nights are getting chilly even this far south, so it's going to be very cold up on the North Cape.
I packed it,
he grunted,
for all the good it's going to do. No amount of clothing helps when you're wearing steel.
He made a sour face.
I know it's a contradiction, but I start to sweat the minute I put the armor on. Every knight I've ever known does the same. We keep on sweating even when we're freezing and icicles are forming up inside the armor. Sometimes I wish I'd gone into another line of work. Bashing people for fun and profit starts to wear thin after a while.
You're in a gloomy mood this morning, love.
It's just that it's getting harder and harder to get started. I'll be all right once I'm on the road.
You will be careful, won't you, Sparhawk? I'd die if I lost you.
I'm not going to be in all that much danger, dear. I've got Bellium, and Bellium could pick up the sun and break it across its knee. It's Sirgon and Zelasta who will have to watch out.
Don't get overconfident.
I'm not. I've got more advantages than I can count, that's all. We're going to win, Aelana, and there's nothing in the world that can stop us. All that's really left is the tedious plodding from here to the victory celebration.
Why don't you kiss me for a while, she suggested, before you put on the armor? It takes weeks for the bruises to go away after you kiss me when you're all wrapped in steel.
You know, he smiled, that's an awfully good idea. Why don't we do that?
The column stretched for several miles, undulating across the rounded hills on the east coast of Lake Sama. There were church knights, Etons, Kryn's Poloi, and a few ornately garbed regiments of the Tamil army. It was a splendid day, one of those perfect autumn days with a stiff wind aloft hurrying puffy white clouds across an intensely blue sky, and the enormous shadows of those clouds raced across the rolling landscape so that Sparhawk's army rode alternately in sunshine and in shadow. The pennons and flags were of many hues, and they snapped and rippled in the breeze, tugging at the lances and flagstaffs to which they were fastened. Queen Betwana strode along at Farron's shoulder.
"Are you sure, Sparhawk Knight?" she asked. "The troll beasts are animals, and all animals are born knowing how to swim. Even a cat can swim."
"Only reluctantly, Betwana Queen," Sparhawk smiled, remembering Myrrh's cat paddling in Sophrenia's fish pond in Sarsos. "Ulaf Knight says that we won't have to worry about the troll beasts swimming around the end of the escarpment. They'll swim across rivers and lakes, but the sea terrifies them. It has something to do with the tides, I think, or maybe it's the salt."
"Must we continue at this slow pace?" Her tone was impatient.
"We want to be certain that Zelasta's spies see us, Your Majesty," Venyan told her. "That's a very important part of our plan."
"The lean battles are very large," she observed.
"We'd prefer smaller ones, Aitana, but Zelasta's schemes stretch across the whole continent, so we have to respond."
Sophrenia, with flute riding in front of her, rode forward with Zanisha. They had all watched the tentative friendship growing between Sophrenia and Zanisha. Both were still very cautious, and there were no great leaps in their relationship. The tenuousness now came not from defensiveness, but rather from an excess of concern about inadvertently giving offense, and Sparhawk felt that to be a rather profound change for the good.
"We grew tired of all the stories," Sophrenia told Vanyan. "I can't be sure which is the bigger liar, Tinian or Ulaf."
"Oh?"
"They're trying to outdo each other. Ulaf's exaggerating outrageously, and I'm sure Tinian's doing the same thing. Each of them is doing his level best to persuade the other that he missed the adventure of the century."
"It's a demonstration of a form of affection, little mother," Sparhawk explained. "They'd be too embarrassed to admit that they're genuinely fond of each other, so they tell each other wild stories instead."
"Did you understand that, Zanisha?" Sophrenia smiled. "What reasonable person can ever understand how and why men express their love, sister?"
"Men aren't really comfortable with the word love," Sparhawk told them, "particularly when it's applied to other men."
"It is love, though, isn't it, Sparhawk?" Sophrenia asked him.
"Well, I suppose it is, but we're not comfortable with it all the same."
"I have meant to speak with thee, Anaray."
Betwana lapsed, perhaps unconsciously, into archaic Tamil.
"Gladly I will hear thy words, Queen of Aton."
"It hath been the wont of youthful Aetons to seek Delphaeus, having it in their minds to destroy thine home and to put thy people to the sword.
I am heartily sorry that I have permitted this.
Zanisha smiled.
It is of no moment, Queen of Aetan. This is but an excess of adolescent enthusiasm. I must freely confess that our fledglings do entertain themselves by deceiving and distracting thine, leading them away from their intended goal by rudimentary enchantments and clumsy deceptions. It cometh to me all unbidden that thus we are both relieved of the obligation to entertain our children, who, by virtue of their youth, inexperience, and profound inability to divert themselves, do continually complain that there is nothing for them to do, at least nothing worthy of what they perceive to be their enormous gifts.
Betwana laughed.
Do thy children have that self-same plaint, Anaray?
All children complain,
Sophronia assured them.
It's one of the things that makes parents age so fast.
Well said, Sparhawk agreed.
Neither he nor Sophronia looked directly at Flute. They reached Libas, in northern Tamil, in about 2 days. Sparhawk had spoken with the army, stressing the enormous power of Belium as he explained how it would be possible for them to cover great distances in a short period of time. In actuality, however, Belium was in no way responsible. Flute was in charge of their travel arrangements on this particular trip. There was another Aetan runner waiting for them in Libas, with yet another message from Khalad. A fairly offensive note that suggested that the runner had been sent to guide them to the stretch of beach where Kring and Engesa waited with their forces, since if knights were left to their own devices in the forest, they would inevitably get lost. Khalad's class prejudices were still quite firmly in place. There was no road as such leading north from Libas, but the trails and paths were quite clearly marked. They reached the southern edge of the vast forest that covered the northeastern quadrant of the continent, and the 100 Paloi that Kring had brought with him from Eosia pulled in to ride close to their allies. Deep woods made the plains-dwelling western Paloi very nervous.
"I think it has to do with the sky," Tinian explained to the others.
"You can barely see the sky when you're in the deep woods, Tinian," Kalton objected.
"Exactly my point," the broad-faced Dieran replied. "The western Paloi are accustomed to having the sky overhead. When there are tree limbs blocking their view of it, they start to get nervous."
They were never able to determine if the attempt was random or was deliberately aimed at Betwana. They were 100 leagues or so into the forest and had set up their night's encampment, and the large tent for the ladies, Betwana, Sophronia, Zanisha, and Flute, had been erected somewhat apart, so that they might have a bit of privacy. The assassins were well concealed, and there were 4 of them. They burst out of the thicket with drawn swords, just as Betwana and Zanisha were emerging from the tent. Betwana responded instantly. Her sword whipped out of its sheath and plunged directly into the belly of one of the attackers. Even as she jerked the sword free, she dove to the ground, rolled, and drove both feet full into the face of yet another. Sparhawk and the others were running toward the tent in response to Sophronia's cry of alarm, but the Queen of the Aetons seemed to have things well in hand. She parried a hasty thrust and split the skull of the shabby assailant who had made it. Then she engaged the remaining attacker.
"Look out!" Barrett shouted as he ran toward her.
The man she had felled with her feet was struggling to rise, his nose bleeding and a dagger in his hand. He was directly behind the Aeton Queen. Always before, when Zanisha had shed her disguise, the change had been slow, the concealing coloration receding gradually. This time, however, she flashed into full illumination, and the light within her was no mere glow. Instead, she blazed forth like a new sun. The bloody-nosed assassin might have been able to flee from her had he been in full possession of his faculties. The kick he had received in the face, however, appeared to have rattled him and shaken his wits. He did scream once, though, just before Zanisha's hand touched him. His scream died in a hoarse kind of gurgle. With his mouth agape and his eyes bulging with horror, he stared at the blazing form of she who had just killed him, but only for a moment. After that, it was no longer possible to recognize his expression.
The flesh of his face sagged and began to run down, turned by that dreadful touch into a putrefying liquid. His mouth seemed to gape wider as his cheeks and lips oozed down to drip off his chin. He tried to scream once, but the decay had already reached his throat, and all that emerged from his lipless mouth was a liquid wheeze. The flesh slid off his hand, and his dagger dropped from his skeleton clutch. He sagged to his knees, with a slimy residue of skin and nerve and tendons oozing out of his clothing. Then the rotting corpse toppled slowly forward to lie motionless on the leaf-strewn floor of the forest. Motionless, but still dissolving as Zanisha's curse continued its inexorable course. The NRA's fire dimmed, and she buried her shining face in her glowing hands and wept. Chapter 28. It was raining in Issos, a chill, persistent rain that swept down out of the mountains of Zemak every autumn. The rain did not noticeably dampen the harvest festival celebration, since most of the revelers were too drunk to even notice the weather. Stolg was not drunk. He was working, and he had nothing but contempt for men who drank on the job. Stolg was a nondescript sort of fellow in plain clothing. He wore his hair cropped close, and he had large, powerful hands. He went through the crowd of revelers unobtrusively, moving toward the wealthier quarter of the city. Stolg and his wife Ruta had argued that morning, and that always put him in a bad humor. Ruta really had little cause for complaint, he thought, stepping aside for a group of drunken young aristocrats. He was a good provider, after all, and their neat little cottage on the outskirts of town was the envy of all their friends. Their son was apprenticed to a local carpenter, and their daughter had excellent prospects for a good marriage. Stolg loved Ruta, but she periodically became waspish over some little thing and pestered him to death about it. This time she was upset because their cottage had no proper lock on the front door, and no matter how many times he told her that they, of all people, had no need of locks, she had continued to harp on the subject. Stolg stopped and drew back into a recessed doorway as the watch tramped by. Jukta would normally have bribed the watch to stay out of Stolg's way, but it was harvest festival time, so there would be plenty of confusion to cover any incidental outcries. Jukta was not one to spend money needlessly. It was a common joke in the seedier taverns in Issos that Jukta had deliberately grown his vast beard so that he could save the price of a cloak. Stolg saw the house that was his destination, and went into the foul-smelling alley behind it. He had arranged for a ladder to be placed against the back of the house, and he climbed up quickly and entered through a second-story window. He walked down the hallway and through the door at the end into a bedroom. A former servant in the house had drawn a diagram and had pointed out the room of the owner of the house, a minor nobleman named Count Kynad. Once inside the room, Stolg lay down on the bed. As long as he had to wait, he might as well be comfortable. He could hear the sound of revelry coming from downstairs. As he lay there, he decided to install the lock Ruta wanted. It wouldn't be expensive, and the peace and quiet around the house would be more than worth it. It was no more than half an hour later when he heard a heavy, slightly unsteady footfall on the stair. He rolled quickly off the bed, crossed silently to the door, and put his ear to the panel. "It's no trouble at all," a slurred voice outside said. "I've got a copy in my bedroom."
"Really, Count Kynad?" a lady's voice called from below. "I take your word for it."
"No, Baroness. I want you to read His Majesty's exact words. It's the most idiotic proclamation you've ever seen."
The door opened, and a man carrying a candle entered. It was the man who had been pointed out to Stolg 2 days ago. Stolg idly wondered what Count Kynad had done to irritate someone enough to justify the expense of a professional visit. He brushed the thought aside. That was really none of his business. Stolg was a thorough professional, so he had several techniques available to him. The fact that Count Kynad's back was to him presented the opportunity for his favorite, however. He drew a long poniard from his belt, stepped up behind the count, and drove the long, slim blade into the base of the count's skull, with a steely crunch. He caught the collapsing body and quietly lowered it to the floor. A knife thrust in the brain was always certain, and it was quick, quiet, and produced a minimum of mess. Ruta absolutely hated to wash her husband's work clothes when there was blood all over them. Stolg set his foot between the Count's shoulders and wrenched his poniard out of the back of the skull. That was sometimes tricky. Pulling a knife out of bone takes quite a bit of strength. Stolg rolled the body over and looked intently into the dead face. A professional always makes sure that a client has been permanently serviced. The Count was definitely dead. His eyes were blank, his face was turning blue, and a trickle of blood was coming out of his nose. Stolg wiped off his poniard, put it away, and went back out into the hallway. He walked quietly back to the window through which he had entered. There were two more names on the list Jukta had given him, and with luck he could service another this very night. It was raining, however, and Stolg really disliked working in the rain. He decided to go home early instead, and tell Ruta that he would give in just this once and install the lock she wanted so much. Then he thought it might be nice if they took their son and their daughter to the tavern at the end of the street to have a few tankards of ale with their neighbors. It was the harvest festival after all, and a man should really try to spend the holidays with his friends and family. Shirok was a small, weedy sort of fellow with thinning hair and a lumpy skull. He did not so much walk as scurry through the crowded streets of Varel in southern Taconia. In the daytime, Shirok was a minor official in the custom house, biting his tongue as he took orders from his Tamil superiors. Shirok loathed Tamils, and being placed in a subservient position to them sometimes made him physically ill. It was that loathing which had been primarily behind his decision to sell information to the diseased Styric Ogorajan, to whom a mutual acquaintance had introduced him. When Ogorajan, after a few carefully worded questions, had slyly hinted that certain kinds of information might be worth quite a bit of money, Shirok had leapt at the chance to betray his despised superiors, and to make tidy sums as well. The information he had for Ogorajan tonight was very important. The greedy, blood-sucking Tamils were going to raise the customs rate by a full 0.25%. Ogorajan should pay handsomely for that piece of information. Shirok licked his lips as he rushed through the noisy crowd celebrating the harvest festival. There was an 8-year-old Estellian girl available at one of the slave marts, a ravishing child with huge, terrified eyes, and if Ogorajan could be persuaded to be generous, Shirok might actually be able to buy her. He had never owned a child so young before, and the very thought of her made his knees go weak. His mind was full of her as he passed a reeking alleyway, and so he was not really paying any attention until he felt the strand of wire snap tight around his neck. He struggled, of course, but it was really not much use. The assassin dragged him back into the alley and methodically strangled him. His last thought was of the little girl's face. She actually seemed to be laughing at him.
"You're really more trouble than you're worth, you know," Persola said to the dead man sprawled in the bow of the rowboat. Persola always talked to the men he had killed. Many of Persola's colleagues believed that he was crazy. They were probably right. Persola's major problem lay in the fact that he always did things exactly the same way. He invariably stuck his knife into someone between the third and fourth ribs at a slightly downward angle. It was effective, though, since a knife thrust there absolutely cannot miss the heart. Persola also never left a body lying where it fell. He had a compulsive sense of neatness that drove him to put the remains somewhere out of sight. Since Persola lived and worked in the Daconian town of Edoras on the coast of the Sea of Edom, disposal was a simple matter. A short trip in a rowboat and a few rocks tied to the deceased's ankles removed all traces. Persola's habit-driven personality, however, led him to always sink the bodies in the exact same place. The other murderers of Edoras made frequent laughing reference to Persola's Reef, a place on the lake bottom supposedly piled high with sunken bodies. Even people who didn't fully understand the significance of the phrase referred to Persola's Reef.
"You went and did it, didn't you?"
Persola said to the corpse in the bow of the boat as he rowed out to the reef. You just had to go and offend somebody. You've got nobody to blame but yourself for this, you know. If you'd behaved yourself, none of this would have happened. The corpse did not answer. They almost never did. Ursula stopped rowing and took his bearings. There was the usual light in the window of Fana's tavern on the far shore, and there was the warning fire on the rocky headlands on the near side. The lantern on the wharf, protruding out from Edoras, was dead astern. This is the place, Ursula told the dead man. You'll have lots of company down there, so it won't be so bad. He shipped his oars and crawled forward. He checked the knots on the rope that held the large rock in place between the dead man's ankles. I'm really sorry about this, you know, he apologized, but it is your own fault. He lifted the rock and the dead man's legs over the side. He held the shoulders for a moment. Do you have anything you'd like to say? He asked. He waited for a decent interval, but the dead man did not reply. I didn't really think you would, Persola said. He let go of the shoulders, and the body slithered limply over the gunwale and disappeared into the dark waters of the lake. Persola whistled his favorite tune as he rowed back to Edoras. Avon Wargensen, Prince Regent of Thalesia, was in an absolute fury. Patriarch Bergsten had left Thalesia without so much as a by your leave. It was intolerable. The man had absolutely no regard for the Prince Regent's dignity. Even Wargensen was going to be king one day, after all, just as soon as the raving madman in the North Tower finally got around to dying, and he deserved some courtesy. People always ignored him. That indifferent lack of regard cankered the soul of the little crown prince. Even was scarcely more than 5 feet tall, and in a kingdom absolutely awash with blonde people a foot or more taller, he was almost unnoticeable. He had spent his childhood scurrying like a mouse out from under the feet of towering men who kept accidentally stepping on him because they refused to look down and see that he was there. Sometimes that made him so angry that he could just scream. Then, without even bothering to knock, two burly blonde ruffians opened the door and rolled in a large barrel. "Here's that cask of Archean Red you wanted, Avon," one of them said. The ignorant barbarian didn't even know enough to use a proper form of address. I didn't order a barrel of wine, Avon snapped. The chief of the guard said you wanted a barrel of Archean Red, the other blonde savage declared, closing the door. We're just doing what we were told to do. Where do you want this? Oh, put it over there, Avon said, pointing. It was easier than arguing with him. They rolled the barrel across the floor and set it up in the corner. I don't think I know you two, Avon said. We're new. The first one shrugged. We just joined the Royal Guard last week. He set a canvas bag on the floor and took out a pry bar. He carefully inserted the bar under the lid of the barrel and worked it back and forth until the lid came free. What are you doing? Avon demanded. You can't drink it if you can't get at it, Avon, the fellow pointed out. We've got the right tools, and you probably don't. At least the man was clean-shaven. Even approved of that. Most of the men in the Royal Guard looked like trees with golden moss growing on them. You'd better taste it and make sure it hasn't soured, Brock. Right, the other one agreed. He scooped up some of the wine in the cupped palm of his hand and sucked it in noisily. Avon shuddered. Tastes all right to me, Tell, he reported. A thoughtful look crossed his face. Why don't I fill up a bucket of this before we put the lid back on? He suggested. Hauling this barrel up the stairs was heavy business, and I've worked up quite a thirst. Good idea, Tell agreed. The bearded man picked up the brass-bound wooden bucket Avon used for a wastebasket. Is it all right if I use this, Avon? He asked. Avon Wargensen gaped at him. This went too far, even in Thalesia. The burly fellow shook the contents of the wastebasket out on Avon's desk and dipped it into the barrel. Then he set the pail on the floor. I guess we're ready, Tell, he said. All right, Tell replied. Let's get at it. What are you doing? Avon demanded in a shrill voice as the two approached him. They didn't even bother to answer. It was intolerable. He was the Prince Regent.
People had no right to ignore him like this.
They picked him up by the arms and carried him over to the barrel, ignoring his cries and struggles. He couldn't even get their attention by kicking them.
In you go, the one named Tell said pleasantly,
almost in the tone one uses when he pushes a horse into a stall. The two lifted Avon Wargensen quite easily and stuffed him feet first into the barrel. The one called Brock held him down, while Tell took a hammer and a handful of nails out of the canvas bag and picked up the barrel lid. He set the lid on Avon's head and pushed him down. Then he wrapped his hammer around the edge of the lid, settling it in place. Only Avon's eyes and forehead were above the surface of the wine. He held his breath and pounded impotently on the underside of the lid with both fists. Then there was another pounding sound as well, as Tell calmly nailed down the lid of the barrel. The ladies quite firmly dismissed Calton when they set out the morning after the attempt on Queen Betwana's life. Calton took his self-appointed duties as Zanisha's protector quite seriously, and he was a bit offended at being so cavalierly sent away.
"They need some privacy right now," Venyan told him. "Set some knights to either side to protect them, but give them enough room to get Zanisha through this."
Venyan was a soldier, but his insights were sometimes quite profound. Sparhawk looked back over his shoulder. Sophronia rode close to one side of the sorrowing Zanisha, and Betwana strode along on the other. Zanisha rode with her head bowed, holding flute in her arms. There was about them a kind of exclusionary wall as they closed ranks around their injured companion. Sophronia rode very close to the Anorae, frequently reaching out her hand to touch the stricken woman. The racial differences and eons-old enmity appeared to have been overridden by the universal sisterhood of all women. Sophronia reached across those barriers to comfort her enemy without even thinking about it. Betwana was no less solicitous, and in spite of the gruesome demonstration of the effects of Zanisha's touch, she walked very close to the Delphaic woman. Afriel, of course, was in complete control of the situation. She rode with her arms about Zanisha's waist, and Afriel's touch was one of the more powerful forces on Earth. Sparhawk was quite certain that Zanisha was not really suffering. The child goddess would not permit that. The Enere's apparent horror and remorse at what she had been compelled to do was primarily for the benefit of her two comforters. Afriel was quite deliberately erasing Sophronia's racial animosity and Betwana's superstitious aversion by the simple expedient of intensifying Zanisha's outward appearance of grief. It was easy to underestimate Afriel when she appeared in one of her innumerable incarnations as a capricious little girl, and that was probably the main reason she had chosen the form of the child goddess in the first place. Sparhawk, however, had seen the reality of Afriel waveringly reflected in the brass mirror back in Mytherian, and the reality was neither childish nor whimsical. Afriel, he guessed, generally knew exactly what she was doing, and generally got exactly what she wanted. Sparhawk firmly fixed the wavering image of the reality of Afriel in his mind, so that it would always be present when the dimples and the kisses began to cloud his judgment. The days were significantly shorter this far to the north. The sun rose far to the southeast now, and it did not go very high above the southern horizon before it started to descend again. Each long night's frost piled up on the previous night's lacy blanket, since the pale, weak sun no longer had the strength to melt what had built up during the hours of darkness. It was nearly sunset when a towering Aton came loping down a frosty forest path to meet them. He went directly to Queen Betwana, banged his fist against his chest in salute, and spoke urgently. Betwana motioned quickly to Sparhawk and the others.
"A message from Engessa Aton," she said tersely. "There are enemies gathering on the coast at the eastern end of the wall."
"Trolls?" Vanyan asked quickly.
The tall Aton shook his head.
"No, Vanyan Lord," he replied. "They're Alines, and for the most part they're not warriors. They're cutting trees."
"To use in building fortifications?" Bevier asked.
"No, Church Knight. They are lashing the trees together to build things that will float."
"Rafts?" Tinian asked.
"Olaf, you said that trolls are afraid of the sea. Would they be willing to use rafts to go around the outer edge of the escarpment?"
It's hard to say,
the blonde-braided Thalesian replied.
Guerig did use a boat to cross Lake Ven, and he almost had to have stolen a ride on some ship to get from Thalesia to Pelosia when he followed King Sarek during the Zemok War. But Guerig wasn't like other trolls.
He looked at the Aton.
Are they building these rafts north of the wall, or here on the south side?
They're on this side of the wall, the Aton replied.
That doesn't make too much sense, does it?
Kalten asked.
Not to me, it doesn't,
Ulaf admitted.
I think we'd better get up there and have a look, Sparhawk,
Venyan said.
That attack on Betwana last night was fair evidence that Zelasta knows we're coming. So this little stroll through the woods has accomplished its purpose. Let's join forces with Engessa and Kring and find out if Sorgai's made it to the beach yet. Winter's coming on fast, and I think we'll want to deal with the trolls before the sun goes down permanently.
Would you see to that, Divine One?
Sparhawk said to Afriel.
I'd ask Belium to do it, but you've been handling things so well that I wouldn't want to appear critical by taking over at this point.
Afriel's eyes narrowed.
Don't push your luck, Sparhawk,
she said ominously.
Sparhawk was never really certain whether Afriel had somehow moved them during the night or had slipped them across the intervening miles at some point between the time when they swung up into their saddles and the time when their mounts took their first steps. The child goddess was too practiced, too skilled, to be caught tampering when she didn't want to be. The hill was the same hill that had been lying to the northwest of their night's encampment when the sun had gone down. Or so it seemed. But when they crested it about a half hour after they set out, there was a long sandy beach and a lead-gray expanse of the Tommel Sea on the other side, instead of a broad, unbroken forest.
That was quick, Talon said, looking around.
Talon's presence on this expedition had never really been explained to Sparhawk's satisfaction. He suspected Afriel, however. It was easy to suspect Afriel of such things, and more often than not, the suspicions proved to be well-founded.
There's someone coming down the beach,
Ulaf said, pointing at a tiny figure riding along the water's edge from the north.
Halad,
Talon shrugged.
How can you tell?
He's my brother, Sir Ulaf. Besides, I recognize his cloak.
They rode on down the hill and out onto the sand.
What kept you?
Halad asked Sparhawk bluntly when he joined them.
I'm glad to see you too, Halad.
Don't try to be funny, Sparhawk. I've been struggling to keep Engessa and his Aetons from swimming around the outer edge of the escarpment for the past 10 days. They want to go attack the trolls all by themselves. How did Stragan's plan come off?
It's hard to say, Talon told him. We were on the road during the Harvest Festival. I know Stragan and Kaalador well enough to know that most of the people they were after are probably dead by now. We were a little late because we wanted to make sure that Zelasta's people saw us coming. We thought we might be able to divert him enough to keep him out of the way of Kaalador's murderers.
Halad grunted.
Are the trolls gathering anywhere nearby?
Ulaf asked.
As closely as we can tell, they're all clustered around the abandoned village of Tezada, over on the other side of the Aetan border,
Halad replied.
They tried to climb the wall for a while, then they pulled back. Engessa's got scouts on top of the wall. They'll let us know when the trolls start to move.
Where are Engessa and Kring?
Venyan asked him.
Up the beach about a mile, my lord. We've built an encampment back in the forest a ways. Takumi's joined us. He brought in several thousand of the eastern Poloi about 5 days ago.
That should help, Kalten said. The Poloi are very enthusiastic about their wars. Any sign of Sorgai yet?
Sparhawk asked.
He's feeling his way in through the reefs,
Halad replied.
He sent a longboat ahead to let us know he was coming.
What's this business with the rafts all about?
Venyan asked him.
They aren't rafts, my lord. They're sections of a floating bridge.
A bridge? A bridge to where?
We aren't sure. We've been staying back so that the Edomish peasants constructing it won't see us.
What are Edomishmen doing on this side of the continent?
Kalten asked, with some astonishment.
building a bridge, Sir Colton. Weren't you listening? Talon's old friend Amador, or Rebal, or whatever he calls himself, is sort of in charge. But Incedes is there, too, and he's the one who's making the big impression. He bellows orders in Archaic Hellenic, and he's been braining anyone who doesn't understand him or move fast enough.
Is that the counterfeit one we saw in the woods near Jorson? Talon asked.
I don't think so. This fellow seems to be quite a bit bigger, and he's got a sizable contingent of men in bronze armor with him. I'd guess that somebody's resurrecting people out of the past again.
That would probably be Jarian of Samar, Sophrenia said. Maybe he can raise whole armies after all.
He can if Sirgon's lending him a hand, Afriel added.
The child goddess had appeared to be dozing in her sister's arms, but she had clearly been listening. She opened her large, dark eyes.
Hello, Khalad, she said. You look a little wind-burned.
We've had some gales coming in off the Tamil Sea, Divine One. There's a strong smell of ice mixed up in them.
That's what they're doing, Ulath said, snapping his fingers.
Does he still do that? Tinian asked. I was hoping you'd cured him of it by now.
Ulath likes to play leapfrog with his mind, Tinian, Sophrenia said calmly. He'll come back in a moment or two and fill in the blank spaces for us.
How long has it been cold up here, Khalad? Ulath asked. It wasn't particularly warm when we got here, Sir Ulath. Is any ice forming up in the inlets and along the beach at night?
Some.
It isn't very thick, though, and the tide comes in and breaks it up before it has the chance to spread.
The floating ice a mile or so out to sea isn't breaking up, though, Ulath said. It rises and falls with the tide because it's not grinding up against the rocks. It's probably almost a foot thick out there by now. The Edomishmen aren't building rafts or a bridge. They're building a pier out to that pack ice. There'll be another one north of the wall as well. The trolls will cross the ice. We know that because they did it to get here from Thalesia. Sirgon's going to march the trolls to the pier north of the wall and drive them out to the pack ice. Then they'll march south across the ice and come ashore on this south pier.
And then they'll attack the Aetons again. Vanyan said bleakly. How thick will the pack ice have to be to support the weight of the trolls?
2 feet or so. It should be thick enough by the time the piers are finished, if it stays cold.
I think we can count on Sirgon to make sure that it stays cold, Tinian noted.
There's something else, too,
Khalad added.
If Sirgon's playing with the weather this way, it won't be too long before Sorgai's ships are locked in ice. I think we'd better come up with something, my lords, and fairly soon, or we are going to be hip-deep in trolls again.
Let's go talk with Kring and Engessa, Sparhawk said.
Chapter 29
The beach has changed, friend Sparhawk, Kring was saying. When you get close to the cliff, there's about a mile of what used to be the sea bottom that's out of the water now.
It looks as if Belium pushed the land from north of the break underneath the rest of the continent,
Khalad added.
It sort of slid under and pushed this side of the crack upward to form the cliff. That's what raised the sea bottom on this side. The land to the north of the cliff sank, though, so the sea went a couple of miles inland. You can see treetops sticking up out of the water. The break was clean and straight back where we were when the earthquake started, but there were a lot of landslides out here on the coast. There are big rocks sticking up out of the water north of the cliff.
Where are those Edomishmen you mentioned? Vanyan asked.
Up near the top of the cliff, my lord. They're cutting trees and rolling the logs down to the edge of the water. That's where they're building the rafts.
Khalad paused, his expression slightly critical.
They aren't very good rafts, he added. If the trolls try to come ashore on that floating pier, they're going to get their feet wet.
He's his father's son, all right, Colton laughed. Why do you care whether or not the trolls get their feet wet, Khalad?
If you're going to do something, you should do it right, Sir Colton,
Khalad said stubbornly.
I hate sloppy workmanship.
Where's this place the trolls are gathering? Vanyan asked. What was its name again?
Tzada, Vanyan Preceptor, Angessa replied. It's over in Eitan.
What are they doing?
It's a little hard to tell from the top of the cliff.
Where's the border between Tamil proper and Eitan? Tinian asked.
There isn't any real border, Tinian Knight, Queen Betwana told him. It's just a line drawn on the map, and the line doesn't mean anything up here on the North Cape. A land where the sun goes down in the late autumn and doesn't come up again until early spring, and where the trees freeze and explode in midwinter, doesn't attract too many settlers. The western part of the Cape's supposed to be in Astell, the middle's in Eitan, and the east is called part of Tamil proper. Nobody up here really pays any attention to things like that. The land belongs to anybody foolish enough to live this far north.
It's about 150 leagues to Tzada, Angessa told them.
That's a good week's travel for a troll, Ulath said. How far along are the Adomishmen with their pier?
Khalad scratched his cheek.
I guess that they've got a good 10 more days before they finish.
And in 10 days the pack ice out to sea should be thick enough to hold the weight of the trolls,
Ulath concluded.
Sirgan will make sure it's thick enough, Flute said.
Somebody's doing some very tight scheduling, Bevier noted. The Adomishmen will have their piers complete in 10 days. The ice will be thick enough to walk on, and if the trolls set out from Tzada 3 days from now, they'll get here just when everything's ready.
We have all sorts of options here, Vanyan said. We could destroy this southern pier and leave the trolls stranded out on the ice. We could just wait and meet them when they try to come ashore. We could use Sorgai's ships to assault them while they're on the pier itself. Or we could...
Queen Betwana was firmly shaking her head.
Something wrong, Your Majesty? Vanyan asked her.
We don't have that much time, Vanyan Preceptor, she replied. How long is the daylight here now, Angessa Eitan?
Not much more than 5 hours, Betwana Queen.
In 10 days it won't even last that long. Do we want to fight trolls in the dark?
Not even a little bit, Your Majesty.
Ulath shuddered.
The point is that we don't really want to fight them at all. We want to steal them. We could just ignore all this construction work here on the coast, you know. Sorgai's ships could ferry us around these work gangs and put us ashore far enough north of the escarpment so that Belium won't set off a new batch of earthquakes, and then we could have it carry us directly to Tzada.
That's a good plan, Ulath Knight, Betwana agreed, except for the ice. It's already forming out there, you know.
Afriel, Sparhawk said to the child goddess, could you melt that ice for us?
If I really had to, she replied, but it wouldn't be polite. The ice is a part of winter, and winter belongs to the earth. The earth is Belium's child, not mine, so you'll have to talk to Belium about it.
What should I ask it to do?
She shrugged.
Why not just leave that up to Belium? Tell it that the ice is a problem, and let it decide how to deal with it. You've got a lot to learn about the etiquette of these situations, Sparhawk.
I suppose so, he admitted, but it's the sort of thing that doesn't come up every day, so I haven't had much practice.
You see what I mean about those rafts, Sparhawk?
Khalad said.
Those green logs lie so low in the water that you couldn't lead a donkey along that pier without getting him wet all the way up to the hocks.
How would you have built them?
I'd have used a double layer of logs, one layer across the top of the other.
The two of them were lying under some bushes on a knoll, watching the Adomish peasants laboring on the rafts. The first part of the pier was already anchored in place, and it jutted about 1/4 mile out into the icy water. Additional rafts were being added to the outer end as quickly as they were completed.
There's Incides,
Khalad said, pointing at a huge man in a bronze mail shirt and horned helmet.
He and those prehistoric warriors he brought with him have been driving those poor peasants to the point of exhaustion. Ribal's running around waving his arms and trying to look important, but it's Incides who's really in charge. The peasants don't seem to understand his dialect, so he's been talking to them by hand.
Khalad scratched his short black beard.
You know, Sparhawk, if we killed him, his warriors would vanish, and one charge by the knights would chase Rebal and his peasants halfway back to Edom.
It's a nice idea, but how are we going to get close enough to kill him?
I'm already close enough, Sparhawk. I could kill him from right here.
He's 250 paces away, Khalad. Your father said that the maximum range with a crossbow is 200 yards, and even that involved a lot of luck.
I'm a better shot than father was.
Khalad lifted his crossbow.
I've modified the sights and lengthened the arms a bit. Incedes is close enough. Believe me, I could stick a bolt up his nose from here.
That's a graphic picture. Let's go talk with Vanyan.
They slid back down the back of the knoll, mounted their horses, and rode back to their hidden encampment. Sparhawk quickly explained his squire's plan to the others.
Are you sure you could hit him at that range, Khalad?
Vanyan asked a bit skeptically. Khalad sighed.
Do you want a demonstration, my lord?
He asked.
Vanyan shook his head. No. If you tell me you can hit him, then I'll believe you.
All right. I can hit him, my lord.
That's good enough for me.
Vanyan frowned.
What would you say might be the absolute extreme range of the crossbow? He asked.
Khalad spread his hands uncertainly.
I'd have to experiment, Lord Vanyan,
he said.
I'm sure I could build one that will reach out 1,000 yards, but aiming it would be difficult, and it would probably take 2 men a half hour to recock it. The arms would have to be very stiff.
1,000 paces, Vanyan sighed, shaking his head.
He wrapped his knuckles on the chest of his suit of armor.
I think we're becoming obsolete, gentlemen.
Then he straightened.
Well, we're not obsolete yet. As long as we're here anyway, let's go ahead and neutralize this southern pier. All it's going to cost us is 1 crossbow bolt and 1 single mounted charge. The dismay it's going to cause our enemies is worth that much anyway.
Kring and Takumi came riding up the hill from the beach with Captain Sorgai clattering along beside him. Sorgai was not a very good horseman, and he rode stiffly, clinging to the saddle bow.
Friend Sorgai came ashore in one of those rowboats, Kring said. His big boats are still about 1 mile out in the water. Ships, friend Kring,
Sorgai corrected with a pained expression.
The little ones are boats, but the big ones are called ships. What's the difference, friend Sorgai? A ship has a captain. A boat operates by mutual consent.
Sorgai's expression grew somber.
We have a problem, Master Clough. The ice is forming up right behind my ships. I'll be able to bring them ashore, but I don't think they'll be of much use to you. I've had soundings taken, and we'll have to sail a couple of miles out to get around the reef that runs out to sea from that cliff. We don't have those 2 miles anymore. The ice is moving inshore very fast.
You'd better talk with Belium, Sparhawk, Afriel said. I think I told you that this morning.
Yes, he agreed. As a matter of fact, you did.
Why didn't you do it, then?
I had a few other things on my mind.
They get like that as they grow older, Sophronia told her sister. They get mulish and deliberately put off doing things they're supposed to do just because we suggest them. They hate being told what to do.
What's the best way to get around that?
Sophronia smiled sweetly at the warriors standing around her.
I've always had good luck with telling them to do the exact opposite of what I really want.
All right,
the child goddess said dubiously.
It sounds silly to me, but if it's the only way to get the job done...
She drew herself up.
Sparhawk,
she said in a commanding voice,
don't you dare talk to Belium.
Sparhawk sighed.
I wonder if Dolmont could find an opening in a monastery for me when I get home, he said.
Sparhawk and Vanyan went off a ways from the others to consult with the Sapphire Rose. Flute trailed along behind them. Sparhawk touched his ring to the lid of the box.
Open, he said.
The lid snapped up.
Blue Rose,
Sparhawk said.
Winter doth approach with unseemly haste, and the freezing of the sea doth hinder our design. We would proceed some distance beyond thine excellent wall, so that our movements will not perturb thy daughter. Thou art considerate, Annika, Vanyan's voice replied.
His courtesy is not untainted by self-interest, Flower Gem, Afriel said with an impish little smile. When thy daughter shudders, it doth unsettle his stomach.
You didn't have to say that, Afriel, Sparhawk told her. Are you going to do this?
No, my manners are better than that.
Why did you come along, then?
Because I owe Belium an apology, and it owes me an explanation.
She looked into the golden cask, and the azure glow from the stone illuminated her face. She spoke directly to the stone in a language Sparhawk did not understand, although it was somehow tantalizingly familiar. There were pauses as she spoke, places during which Sparhawk presumed Belium was responding, communing directly with her in a voice that only she could hear. At one point she laughed, peal upon peal of silvery laughter that almost seemed to sparkle in the chill air.
All right, Sparhawk, she said finally. Belium and I have finished apologizing to each other. You can go ahead and present your problem now.
You're too kind, he murmured.
Be nice.
I would not trouble thee with our trivial concerns, Blue Rose, Sparhawk said then. But methinks the onset of the winter ice hath been hastened by Sirgon's hand, and it is beyond our power to respond.
Vanyan's tone was stern, as Belium replied.
Methinks Sirgon doth need instruction in courtesy, Annika, and perchance in humility as well. He hath bent his will to the premature formation of the ice. I will tweak his beard for this. There are rivers in the sea, and he hath turned one of these aside to freeze this coast in furtherance of his design. I will turn aside yet another, and bring the torrid breath of tropic climes to this northern shore and consume his ice.
Afriel clapped her hands together with a delighted laugh.
What's so funny? Sparhawk asked her.
Sirgon's going to be a little sick for a few days, she replied. Thou art wise beyond measure, Flower Gem, she said gaily.
Thou art kind to say so, Afriel, but methinks thy praise hath some small taint of flattery to it.
Well, she said, a little, perchance, but overfulsome praise for those we love is no sin, is it?
Guard well thine heart, Annika, Belium advised. The child goddess will steal it from thee when thou dost least expect it. She did that years ago, Blue Rose, Sparhawk replied.
I can do this myself, Sparhawk, Khalad whispered. I don't need a chaperone.
The two were lying behind a log atop the knoll from which they had observed the Edomish workmen the previous day. The work gangs were laboring by the smoky light of fires being fed with green wood. The moon was full, and the smoke from the fires seemed almost to glow in its pale light.
I just came along to admire the shot, Khalad, Sparhawk replied innocently. I like to watch professionals in action. Besides, I have to give Ulath the signal just as soon as you put in Cetes to sleep. He shivered. Aren't we a bit early? He asked. The sky won't start to get light for another hour yet. All we're doing here is sprouting icicles.
Did you want to do this?
No. I probably couldn't even come close at this range.
Then do you want to keep your mouth shut and let me do it?
You're awfully grouchy for so young a fellow, Khalad. That doesn't usually set in until a man's much older.
Dealing with knights has prematurely aged me.
How does this new sight of yours work?
Do you know what the word trajectory means?
Sort of. Khalad shook his head wearily.
Never mind, Sparhawk. My calculations are accurate. Just take my word for it.
You actually work it out on paper?
Paper's cheaper than a bushel of new crossbow bolts.
It sounds to me as if you spend more time calculating and adjusting your sights than you do shooting.
Yes,
Khalad admitted.
but if you do it right, you only have to shoot once.
Why did we come out so early, then?
To give my eyes time to adjust to the light. The light's going to be peculiar when I make the shot. I'll have moonlight, firelight, and the first touches of dawn in the sky when the time comes. It'll all be changing, and I need to watch it change so that my eyes are ready. I've also got to pick Incides out and keep a close eye on him. Killing his second cousin won't do the job.
You think of everything, don't you?
Somebody has to.
They waited. The pale light of the full moon made the sand of the newly emerged mile-wide beach intensely white, almost the same as snow, and the night air was bitingly cold.
Keep your head down, Sparhawk, or hold your breath.
What?
Your breath is steaming. If somebody looks this way, he'll know that we're here.
They're 250 paces away, Khalad.
Why take chances if you don't have to?
Khalad peered intently at the ant-like figures working at the edge of the trees.
Is Empress Elisun still chasing Barret?
He asked after a few moments.
She seems to be branching out a bit. I think she caught him a few times, though.
Good. Barret was awfully stuffy when he was younger. He's in love with your wife, you know.
Yes, we talked about it some years back.
It doesn't bother you?
No, it's just one of those infatuations young men go through. He doesn't really intend to do anything about it.
I like Barret. He'll make a good knight, once I grind off the remnants of his nobility. Titles make people a little silly.
He pointed.
It's starting to get light off to the east.
Sparhawk glanced out across the icy reaches of the North Tommel Sea.
Yes, he agreed.
Khalad opened a leather pouch he had brought along and took out a length of sausage.
A bite of breakfast, my lord?
He offered, reaching for his dagger.
Why not?
The first faint touches of light along the eastern horizon faded back into darkness as the false dawn came and went. No one had ever satisfactorily explained that particular phenomenon to Sparhawk. He had seen it many times during his exile in Rendor.
We've still got about another hour, he told his squire.
Khalad grunted, lay back against the log, and closed his eyes.
I thought you were here to watch, Sparhawk said. How can you watch if you're asleep?
I'm not sleeping, Sparhawk. I'm just resting my eyes. Since you came along anyway, you can watch for a while.
The true dawn began to stain the eastern sky some time later, and Sparhawk touched Khalad's shoulder.
Wake up, he said quietly.
Khalad's eyes opened quickly.
I wasn't asleep.
Why were you snoring then?
I wasn't. I was just clearing my throat.
For half an hour?
Khalad rose up slightly and peered over the top of the log.
Let's wait until the sun hits those people, he suggested. That bronze breastplate Incides is wearing should gleam in the sunlight, and a brighter target's easier to hit.
You're the one doing the shooting.
Khalad looked at the laboring Edomish peasants.
I just had a thought, Sparhawk. They've built a lot of those rafts. Why waste them?
What did you have in mind?
Even if Belium melts Sirgan's ice, it's going to take Captain Sorgai a couple of days to ferry all of us around that reef. Why not use these rafts? Sorgai can put a good-sized force on the beach a few miles north of the pier that's probably being constructed on the other side of the wall, and the rest of us can slip around the reef from this side on those rafts. And we can jump the people up there from both sides.
I thought you didn't like these rafts.
I can fix them, Sparhawk. All we have to do is take two of them, lay one on top of the other, and we'll have one good one. Sirgan might have more forces up here on the North Cape than just the trolls. I think we'll want to put all these rafts well out of his reach. Don't you?
You're probably right. Let's talk to Vanyan about it.
Sparhawk looked at the eastern horizon.
The sun's starting to come up.
Khalad rolled over and laid his crossbow across the log. He carefully checked the settings on his sighting mechanism, and then settled the stock against his shoulder. Incides was standing on a tree stump in the full light of the half-risen sun. He was waving his arms and bellowing incomprehensible exhortations to his exhausted workmen.
"Are we ready?"
Khalad asked, laying his cheek against the stock and squinting through the sight.
"I'm ready, but you're the one who has to shoot."
"No talking. I have to concentrate now."
Khalad drew in a deep breath, let part of it out, and then stopped breathing entirely. In Cetes, gleaming golden in the new-risen sun, stood bellowing and waving his arms. The Titan from prehistory looked tiny, almost toy-like in the distance. Khalad slowly, deliberately squeezed the release lever. The crossbow thumped heavily, its rope-thick gut string giving off a deep-toned twang. Sparhawk watched the bolt arc upward.
"Got him,"
Khalad said with a certain satisfaction.
"The arrow hasn't even reached him yet," Sparhawk objected.
"It will. Encides is dead. The arrow will go right through his heart. Go ahead and signal Ulaf to charge."
"Aren't you being a little..."
A vast cry of chagrin rose from the crowd at the edge of the forest. Encides was toppling slowly backward, and the Bronze Age warriors surrounding him wavered and vanished even as he fell.
"You've got to learn to have a little more faith, Sparhawk,"
Khalad noted.
"When I tell you that somebody's dead, he's dead, even if he doesn't know it yet. Were you planning to signal Ulaf sometime today?"
"Oh, I almost forgot."
"Age does that to people, or so I've been told."
"The ministries are corrupt, Elana. I'll be the first to admit that. But if I have to rebuild the government from the ground up, I'll spend the rest of my life at it, and I'll never get anything else done."
Sarabian's tone was pensive.
"But Pandya Subat's such an incompetent,"
Elana objected.
"I want him to be an incompetent, dear heart. I'm going to reverse the usual roles. He's going to be the figurehead, and I'm going to be the one pulling the strings. The other ministers are in the habit of obeying him, so having him as prime minister won't even confuse them. I'll write Subat's speeches for him and terrorize him to the point that he won't depart from the prepared text. I'll terrorize him to the point that he won't even change clothes or shave without my permission. That's why I want him to sit in and hear the reports of Milord Stragan's unique solution to our recent problem. I want him to imagine the feel of the knives going in every time he has an independent thought."
"Might I make a suggestion, Your Majesty?"
Stragan asked. "By all means, Stragan." Sarabian smiled. "The stunning success of your outrageous scheme has earned you a sizable balance of imperial indulgence." Stragan smiled and began to pace the floor, his face deep in thought, and his fingers absently weighing a gold coin. Elana wondered where he had picked up that habit.
"The Society of Thieves is classless, Your Majesty," he pointed out. "We're firm believers in the aristocracy of talent, and talent shows up in some of the strangest places. You might want to consider including some people who aren't Tamils in your government. Racial purity is all well and good, I suppose, but when every government official of rank in every subject kingdom is a Tamil, it stirs the kind of resentment that Zelasta and his friends have been exploiting. A more ecumenical approach might dampen those resentments. If an ambitious man sees the chance for advancement, he's much less likely to want to throw off the yoke of the godless yellow devils."
"Are they still calling us that?" Sarabian murmured.
He leaned back. "It's an interesting notion, Stragan. First I ruthlessly crush rebellion, and then I invite the rebels into the government. It should confuse them, if nothing else." Mirtai opened the door to admit Kaalador.
"What's afoot?"
Elana asked him.
"Our friends at the Seneskan Embassy are very busy, Your Majesty," he reported. "Evidently our unusual celebration of the Harvest Festival made them nervous. They're bringing in supplies and reinforcing the gates. It looks as if they're expecting trouble, and they're getting ready to fort up."
"Let them," Sarabian shrugged. "If they want to imprison themselves, it saves me the trouble of doing it."
"Is Krager still inside?" Elana asked. Kaalador nodded. "I saw him walking across the courtyard this morning, my very own self."
"Keep an eye on him, Kaalador," she instructed.
"I purely will, Dorlan," he grinned. "I purely will."
Vanyan led the charge up the beach. The knights and the Poloi descended upon the demoralized work gangs in a thunderous rush, while Angessa's Aetons ran along the water's edge to the foot of the makeshift pier
to cut off the escape of those laboring to extend it farther out into the chill waters of the Tamil Sea. The ribbon clerk, Amador, was shrieking orders from the pier, but no one was really paying much attention to him. Some few of the workmen who had been cutting trees put up a feeble resistance, but most fled back into the forest. It only took a few minutes for those who had chosen to resist to realize that the decision had been a bad one, and they threw down their weapons and raised their hands in surrender. The knights, trained to be merciful, readily accepted surrenders. Takumi's Poloi did so only reluctantly. The Etons on the pier tended to ignore those who sued for mercy, pausing only long enough to kick them off into the water. With Betwana and Engesa in the lead, the Etons marched ominously out onto the pier, killing anybody who offered any resistance, and throwing the rest into the chill water on either side. The men in the water struggled to shore to be rounded up by the Tamil soldiers from the Imperial garrison at Mathurian. The soldiers' presence was primarily a gesture, since they were ceremonial troops, unprepared by either their training or their natural inclinations for fighting. However, they were quite good at rounding up the shivering men who emerged, dripping and blue with the cold, from the icy water.
"I'd say that Belium's warm current hasn't arrived yet," Khalad observed.
"It wouldn't seem so," Sparhawk agreed. "Let's go on down. The days are very short now, and I'd like to secure the North Pier before the sun goes down."
"If there is a North Pier," Khalad said.
"There has to be one, Khalad."
"You wouldn't mind if I ambled over to the edge of the cliff and had a look for myself, would you? Logic is all well and good, but a little verification never hurt anything."
They walked back down the knoll, mounted, and rode out to join their friends.
"Not much of a fight," Kalton complained, looking disdainfully at the mob of terrified prisoners.
"Those are the best kind," Tinian told him.
"Sore guy's coming,"
Ulaf told them, pointing at the fleet moving toward the beach.
"As soon as Betwana and Engesa finish clearing the pier, we'll be able to get started."
The Etons were halfway to the end of the pier by now, and the terrified Edomishmen were being crowded into a tighter and tighter mass by that inexorable advance.
"How cold is that water?" Talon asked. "I mean, has it started to warm up at all?"
"Not noticeably," Ulaf said. "I saw a fish swim by earlier wearing a fur coat."
"Do you think a man could swim back to shore from the end of the pier?"
"Anything's possible,"
Ulaf shrugged.
"I wouldn't want to wager any money on it, though."
Rebal was at the very end of the pier by now, and his screams were growing increasingly shrill. The Etons leveled their spears and continued their inexorable advance. They did not even bother to kill the Edomishmen anymore. They simply shoved everyone off the pier to struggle in the icy water. A large knot of the workmen at the very end of the pier went off the end in a kind of cluster, the ones at the extreme outer end dragging their fellows with them as they toppled off. The Etons lined the sides and the end of the pier, keeping everyone in the water at spear's length from safety. That went somewhat beyond the bounds of civilized behavior, but Sparhawk knew of no diplomatic way to object to Queen Betwana about it, so he ground his teeth together and let it pass. There was a great deal of splashing at first, but that did not last for very long. Singly and in groups, the freezing peasants gave up and slid under the waves. A few athletic ones struck out for shallow water, but no more than a handful reached that questionable safety. Amador, Sparhawk noted, was not among the few survivors being rounded up by the Tamil soldiers at the water's edge. Sorgai's ships were standing at anchor some few yards off the beach by now, and the plans they had all drawn up the night before proceeded smoothly. There was one thing, however, that their planning had not taken into account. Khalad had ridden to the edge of the cliff to look to the north, and he rode back with a slightly worried frown.
"Well?" Sparhawk asked him.
"There's a pier north of the wall, right enough," Khalad replied, dismounting. "But we've got a problem coming up from the south. Belium's warm current is arriving."
"Why is that a problem?"
"I think Belium got a little carried away. It looks as if the leading edge of that current is boiling."
"So?"
"What do you get when you pour boiling water on ice, Sparhawk?"
"Steam, I suppose,"
Right. Bellium's melting the ice out there right enough, but it's raising a lot of steam in the process. What's another word for steam, my lord?
Please don't do that, Khalad. It's very offensive. Just how big is this fog bank?
I couldn't see the end of it, my lord.
Thick?
You could probably walk on it.
Could we possibly stay ahead of it?
Khalad pointed out to sea.
I sort of doubt it, my lord. I'd say it's already here.
The fog was rolling across the water in a thick gray blanket, its leading edge a solid wall, obscuring everything in its path. Sparhawk started to swear.
You seem melancholy, my queen,
Aileen said when the ladies were alone.
Aelana sighed. I don't like being separated from Sparhawk, she said. There were too many years of that when he was in exile.
You've loved him for a long time, haven't you, Your Majesty?
I was born loving Sparhawk. It's really more convenient that way. You don't have to waste time thinking about other possible husbands. You can concentrate all your attention on the one you're going to marry, and make sure you've closed all his escape routes.
There was a knock on the door, and Mirtai rose, put her hand on her sword hilt, and went to answer it. Stragan entered. He was wearing rough clothes.
What on earth have you been up to, my lord?
Melodir asked him.
Pushing a wheelbarrow, Baroness.
He shrugged.
I'm not sure that it accomplishes all that much to disguise myself this way, but it's good to maintain proper work habits. I've been posing as an employee of the Ministry of Public Works. We've been repairing the street outside the Senescan Embassy. Kaalador and I rolled dice, and he won the right to sit on a rooftop to keep watch. I get to trundle wheelbarrow loads of cobblestones to the pavers.
I gather that something's happening at the embassy?
Aelana guessed.
Yes, my queen. Unfortunately, we can't quite figure out what. All the chimneys are spouting smoke that doesn't look like wood smoke. I think they're burning documents. That's usually a sign of incipient flight.
Don't they know they haven't a chance of getting out of town?
Mirtai asked him.
It appears that they're going to make a try anyway. It's just a guess, but I'd say they're planning something that's going to seriously offend the authorities, and then they're going to make a run for it.
He looked at Aelana.
I think we'd better tighten our security arrangements, Your Majesty. All these preparations hint at something serious, and we don't want to be caught off guard.
I'll have a talk with Sarabian, Aelana decided. It was useful to have that embassy functioning as long as Zanisha was here to eavesdrop. Now that she's off with Sparhawk and the others, the embassy's just an irritation. I think it might be time to send in some Aetons to nullify it.
It's an embassy, Your Majesty,
Melodir objected.
We can't just go in and round everybody up. That's against all the rules of civilized behavior.
So?
We don't have much choice, Master Clough. Sorgai said gravely. When you're out in deep water, and this kind of fog comes up, all you can do is put out your sea anchor and hope you don't run aground on some island. You'd never be able to pick your way around the end of that reef with those rafts, and I'd rip the bottoms out of half the ships in the fleet if I tried to slip through the channel between the reef and the ice. We're going to have to wait until this lifts, or thins out at least.
And how long will that be? Sparhawk asked.
There's no way to tell.
The air's colder than the water, Sparhawk,
Khalid explained.
That's what's causing the fog. I don't think it's going to lift until the air warms up. We won't be ready to leave here until tomorrow anyway. We're going to have to do something to raise those rafts up out of the water a bit before we load men and horses on them. If we try to use them the way they are, we'll be trying to move them half-submerged.
Why don't you get started on that, Khalad?
Vanyan suggested.
Sparhawk and I'll go have a talk with Sophrenia and Afriel. We might just need a bit of divine intervention here. Coming, Sparhawk?
The two of them went back on down the beach to the fire Calton had built for the ladies.
Well?
Sophrenia asked. She was seated on a driftwood log with her sister in her lap.
The fog's creating some problems, Vanyan replied. We can't get around the end of the reef until it lifts, and we're a little crowded for time.
We'd like to reach Tezada before the trolls start to march. Any ideas?
A few, Afriel replied. But I'll need to talk with Belium first. There are certain proprieties and courtesies involved, you understand?
No, Sparhawk replied. I don't, really, but I'll take your word for it.
Oh, thank you, Sparhawk, she said with a certain false ingenuousness. I think Belium and I should discuss this in private. Open the box and give it to me.
Whatever you say.
He took out the cask and touched it with his ring.
Open, he told it.
Then he handed the box to the child goddess. She slid off Sophrenia's lap and went down the beach a little way. Then she stood looking out at the fog-enveloped sea. So far as Sparhawk could tell, she was not speaking aloud to the Sapphire Rose. It was about 10 minutes later when she returned and handed the box back to Sparhawk.
It's all taken care of, she told him in an offhand way. When do you want to leave?
Tomorrow morning? Sparhawk asked Vanyan. Vanyan nodded. That should give Khalad time to modify the rafts, and we can get the knights and their horses on board Sorghai's ships and ready to go by then.
All right, Afriel said. Tomorrow, then. Now why don't you go find Uloth and ask him whose turn it is to do the cooking? I'm absolutely famished.
It was not much of a breeze, and it did not entirely dissipate the fog, but they could at least see where they were going, and the tattered remnants of mist would provide them with some cover after they rounded the tip of the reef. Khalad had decided that the quickest way to modify the rafts was to simply double them, pulling one raft on top of another so that the added buoyancy would provide a reasonable freeboard. This made the rafts very cumbersome, of course. They were heavy and hard to steer, and so their progress out along the reef was painfully slow. The skiff leading the way, however, cut through the water ahead of the flotilla and faded into the remnants of the fog bank. Khalad and Barret had announced that they would scout on ahead. After about an hour, the skiff returned.
We marked the channel,
Khalad told them.
That boiling water really cut the ice away, so there'll be plenty of room to get the rafts around the tip of the reef.
We saw Captain Sorghai's ships go by, Barret reported. Apparently he didn't entirely trust the sails. This breeze is a little erratic. He hesitated. You don't have to tell Afriel I said that, of course. Anyway, Sorghai's put the knights to work rowing. They'll get to the beach north of the pier quite some time before we make it to shore.
Are those trees sticking up out of the water going to cause us any problems? Carlton asked.
Not if we stick close to the face of the cliff, Sir Carlton, Khalad replied. The landslides Belium's earthquake set off knocked down all the trees for about 100 yards out from the wall. The trees farther out will give us some additional cover. When you add them to what's left of the fog, I don't think anybody on shore will see us coming.
It's working out fairly well, then,
Uloth said, grunting as he pushed his 20-foot-long pole against the sea bottom.
Except for this part, of course.
We could always swim, Tinian suggested.
No, that's all right, Tinian, Uloth replied. I don't mind poling all that much.
End of side 12. Change side selector switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.